Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I want to thank you for joining us for another special bonus episode. Earlier this year, Barbara sat down with Jerry Heath and Sharon Dobesch, and they discussed how to implement an effective and FSMA-compliant pest management program. That discussion was so well received that they wanted to come back and expand on this topic and answer some of the questions that arose from that discussion. So recently, Barbara reconnected with them and had another insightful conversation that will no doubt be just as engaging as their last. But before we get to that, allow me to reintroduce you to Jerry and Sharon. Sharon Dobesch began with IFC in 2017. Before joining IFC, Sharon spent 16 years as an extension specialist at Kansas State University in pesticide safety and IPM programming, a honeybee specialist, and most recently as the Great Plains Diagnostic Network Associate Director. She also spent 7 years with the Missouri Department of Agriculture as a plant protection specialist inspecting nursery stock, greenhouses, turf farms, and exports. She's currently working on a PhD in stored product insects, specifically the warehouse beetle and larger cabinet beetle. In May of 2018, she completed a graduate certificate in food safety and defense, both degrees from Kansas State University. Jerry Heath has been in the urban industrial pest management industry since 1984. For the last 19 years, Jerry's been a staff entomologist at IFC, where he's involved with technical services for the food processing and commodity industries. Prior to this, he was part of the extension entomology staff at Cornell University, where he developed the Pesticide Impact Assessment Program and received a competitive grant to characterize the occupational exposure of pest management control operators to pesticides. Jerry earned an MS in entomology from the University of Nebraska and has BS degrees from Penn State and Washington State in agriculture and entomology, respectively. All right, now let's hear that discussion.
I'd like to welcome you both to the podcast today, Jerry and Sharon. So, Jerry, let's start with you. What are the top five tips you would give someone when they want to create a pest management program?
Normally, people aren't starting from scratch. Of course, there are new plants that are built and something new has to be established from the ground zero. But more often, we're looking at situations where time has come for a serious upgrade. I'm helping a certain plant as we speak work on a project like this, and it kind of serves as a bit of a case for me to refer back to. And, you know, a new company took over a plant. The new company has big plans for this particular facility to make it a premier facility in their network. And, you know, they're intending to put capital dollars into the place with improvements and produce premier brands in this facility and so on. So they needed to upgrade the facility. So my first suggestion is that this kind of a scenario calls for looking at it from a kind of a 10,000 foot level and really communicating to everybody involved, you know, what the plan is, what they're going to produce, you know, the necessity for, you know, highest possible quality and so forth and so on, and start the process of changing the culture. You know, you could have an older facility and the way we always did things that are no longer going to be acceptable, that need to be emphasized again and again to employees and so forth, that, you know, it's a new game here. So that's first level. Then drilling down to pest management, likewise, everybody needs to be informed. If there's a pest management provider, they need to get the word that, a higher standard of service, new expectations are in play here. and get them on board with the whole thing. You know, of course, in pest management, calls for lots of communication and coordination of different departments, contractors, different people in the facility with different work functions. So, you know, that all has to be drawn together. Very much a communication task, I think. And then next, I think, would be kind of setting priorities. There might be a real train wreck in this particular facility, and it calls for setting the priorities and you know, on a manageable basis, you know, figuring out what can be, what are the priorities for things, challenges to attack first, and recognize that maybe others require longer term corrections and improvements.
Sharon, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I think Jerry's covered it great. Those are our top priorities or concerns when we go into a facility, making sure that they do change that culture. The culture is the hardest part to change in any existing facility or plant.
Now, it occurred to me that, you know, some pests leave telltale signs that a plant might be, you know, wanting to attack straight off. But how much convincing do you have to do for pests that maybe aren't going to show up until they find their way into a product and they get a consumer complaint? Have you encountered that in your work?
Not very often. I suppose, you know, there are always surprises out there. One of the pests that occurs to me in that category are sosids. They're, you know, for the most part, they're not problematic, but you get the right change of environmental conditions, weather patterns that go through, high humidity, and that sort of thing, and suddenly you can have a surprise. And the control for that particular pest is ideally changing those environmental conditions as a remedial factor, get air moving and so forth. But it's a hard thing to really take preventive action against.
Yeah, the only other thing I can think of are those oddball occasional invaders that come up. You know, you don't expect them to populations to just suddenly explode out of nowhere. And it again, it's due to that perfect storm of environmental conditions. And, you know, they've always kind of been there in the background. You know, they're out there as occasional invaders, but suddenly you get this really big population and they get into places that we just don't typically anticipate or look for them just because of their sheer numbers. So that would be the other kind of surprise that we get once in a while.
Sure. So what would you say are some of the most common pests that you see in a food facility?
Different kinds of facilities have, you know, characteristic pests. Dry processing facilities often have high-profile stored product insect pest threats. Wet processing, typically roaches, flies, ants, some of those. Everybody has vulnerability to rodents. So those would be by far, you know, just kind of according to the kind of processing that's going on, would dictate those primary threats.
Sure. What's the most surprising pest you've ever come across?
Oh boy. there have been some real surprises and some real interesting work involved in figuring things out. Some of them actually kind of horrific. You know, I can think of a carcass of a bird that was found in the internal screen of a process. And I guess I've been aware of a couple birds that have managed to find their way into processing screens or things of that nature. And you wonder, how could that ever happen? And then the question then is, you know, what kind of bird is it? You know, if it arrived in a shipment, what's the identification? Is it geographically limited in its range? You know, who can we blame for being the source of this thing, those kinds of questions. It kind of comes down to the receiving of shipments and some manner of capturing foreign material, before it gets into a internal part of the mill or facility, and exclusion measures to keep things from getting in through just openings into bins or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Sharon?
I would say for me, the most surprising one that I found was I actually made an identification of some insects that were sent to me, but you really couldn't make an ID because a lot of the key characters were, I sent a response saying it looks like they've been burned or singed off, because they came out in the very tail end siftings at the end of the process. And when I actually got to go visit the plant, we found out that at the very beginning of the process, there is an incinerator. And the thinking is that these teeny tiny little gnats literally went through the incinerator, had their antennae, their wings, and their legs burned off. And all that was really left is a little body. And it was virtually impossible to tell what they were. And I was actually kind of shocked that I had made the comment that they looked burned, and they really were. So, you know, those kinds of surprises, you get things in the mail randomly and they ask for an ID and you don't always know the full background of where they've been.
Right. Well, that's just testament to your expertise in taxonomy.
There have been some kind of funny ones too. I recall getting a picture of a little lizard that had found itself into a package of shaped crackers, and it was just remarkable how that dried up little lizard so closely resembled some of the real product. And
I think that you're identifying a new marketing trend. So I wouldn't be surprised. You know, there was several years ago the whole bit about cricket flour in tortilla chips and stuff. So maybe we'll see some lizard product. So Sharon, what are some of the most vulnerable hot spots for pest access in facilities?
Some of our most vulnerable hotspots that we always talk about are openings. Open doors is one of our biggest problems. Sometimes gaps around loading doors and other things. Doors and windows people frequently go to or open for ventilation because it's either hot or, you know, something smells bad. They're trying to get odors out, things like that. Those are some of our biggest problems that we run up against. And then there's also some other vulnerabilities that are created by wastes, both indoors and outdoors, where you get attractants, where the insects can come in. Indoors, it's usually in a handling or staging area where doors, like loading doors and things, are left open in order to get that task done. Wastes outside can be things like dumpsters that are kept too close to doors, things like that. And again, unsuitable trailers that are parked at the docks, some that have problems in them already, you open those doors, you let them into your facility. So inbound and outbound shipments are things that need to be checked on a regular basis.
Just to follow up on that last remark about trailers and hotspots in general, really, feed wastes are typically a hot spot in almost every kind of processing plant. It doesn't matter if it's meat processing or some kind of grain-based processing or bakeries, almost anything. All these plants produce wastes, and oftentimes they're held and they're then recycled to use as livestock feed. And we have new rules and regulations that have gotten a fair amount of publicity recently with sanitary transportation. However, feed wastes and things that are going to animal feed are exempt. So sure enough, those decrepit old trailers are being used to haul those feed wastes away. And by and large, the trailers that you see at food processing plants or warehouses are you know, really fine, you know, pieces of equipment in good condition, but those decrepit old trailers have wood floors, cracks and crevices, wall voids along the sides, and they're parked right at the dock, and, you know, and so between the feed wastes and the things they represent within the plant already, and then the decrepit trailers that are parked and coming and going that are rolling infestations, those are very problematic.
So since we've taken a few steps down the transportation thought here, what are some other key factors involved in pest risk in the transportation realm? So with distributors, and what are some best practices that can be taken?
Well, first, I would suggest that everybody reference and go visit the websites where they can read the rules and regulations and understand those, from their own perspective. A couple different categories of transportation. We have bulk transportation, and that might be bulk trailers of all kinds of ingredients. It could be liquids like high fructose corn syrup, or it could be dry materials like flour and other kinds of dry materials. The rules and regulations define bulk transportation as those things where the product is contacting the sidewalls of the container. So it would be like a bulk delivery truck of flour or a bulk rail car, things of those natures. If it's something that's packaged in a super sack or any kind of product packaging, then that's not bulk under the definition of the rules and regulations. So that kind of dictates the condition of the trailer and how it needs to be managed for cleanliness. If it's a true bulk container, it needs to be cleaned and so forth on a schedule, their records kept and all those kinds of things. The real risks in transportation, it seems to me, are mostly at the loading phase. And this goes back to a broader question in the food processing plants or distribution centers where, as Sherman was saying, there can be lots of attractions right outside the door, just literally feet away from the place where trailers are being located or loaded. There are attractions, and there are rarely tight connections of a loading vehicle to the facility. So there's lots of attraction, lots of flies, lots of things going on right there at that edge of the building that are opportunities to get in. Also, that area right where near loading docks is often where shrink wrapping is going on. So things are getting in those little gaps and getting caught up in the shrink wrap and so forth, that then later are found in inspections and so forth and raise questions and possibly rejected shipments. So a lot of those issues are kind of at the border of the building, the interface between the building and the thing that's being loaded. And that's where the risk occurs oftentimes, in my view.
So Sharon, do you have any thoughts about some best practices that could be put into place to combat some of these challenges that Jerry identified?
Yeah, some of the best practices that we recommend is if you do have waste, that you do try and keep it as far away from the facilities and the loading areas as possible. That way it helps hopefully draw those pests away from those areas. Another one is to make sure that, those fittings around the trailers that go to the dock doors are as tight as possible. Make sure that's all in good working order. If something needs to be repaired, repair it. Don't sit around and wait. Dock door closings and seals around dock doors is another thing. Any of those seals around docks and dock doors, as long as they are in good working order, that's about as it's going to be the best you can do. There are still sometimes small gaps and things that things can go through. Again, having trailer inspections, when you get a new trailer up, sometimes if there's a way, if you can inspect it away from the dock door, that would be great before you pull it up to your dock and open it and find out that you've just let something loose into your facility. That's not always possible in all areas. But having a way to inspect those, clean them out ahead of time so that you don't have to open it, accidentally get something into a facility, and maybe even do trailer rejections. And the other thing is, don't be afraid to reject trailers. If they are not clean, there's pests, you know, it's, if something would get into your product once it's loaded onto that trailer, it's on you. So make sure that if your trailers need to be rejected, they are rejected. And I know that's something that a lot of times is kind of hard to do. Drivers and things are not always happy with that scenario if they are rejected. So those would probably be the top ones. Jerry, can you think of anything else?
Well, don't forget empty trailers that are going to be loaded with high quality product as well. Those need to be swept out, be sure that they're in good conditions, no surprises sticking to the sides or the top that came from some previous load or something of that nature.
So it looks like plant employees have a lot of work to do, not only looking around the plant, but also the trailers. What specific things should employees be looking for to determine whether there is an acute pest issue that they need to deal with?
Well, that goes back to one of the fundamentals of pest management. We often use a little graphic that we call the pest management pyramid, and it begins with the foundation of identifying, of knowing the threats and knowing a little bit about the biology of those threats. And inherent in that information are, you know, the identification skills of different life stages, identification of damage, identification of conducive conditions for those particular threats. So that's going to be highly variable according to the facility of what their concerns are. And but that's where it really comes in, to that education in knowing what you're up against and what to look for.
Right. Any thoughts you have, Sharon?
No, the only other thing I can add to that, I think, is, you know, if you do have past year's pest data, look at trending reports, because if you know what you've had in the past and you know that season, that time of year is up and coming, refer to those and try and get ahead of that. So if you know you have a particular pest every year in August, check in July and start making those accommodations to prevent that pest in August. So trending reports can be very valuable because, you know, especially if you have 2-3 years worth of data, that gives you an idea of what your regular ongoing pests are going to be.
So it sounds like you've both mentioned things that a plant could do to facilitate, you know, maintaining a good pest management program. So looking at the environmental conditions when there are unusual pests, keeping track of what you've had in the past and the time of year. Are there other preventive measures that can be put in place that a company should have in place already?
I would say start with things like your sanitation schedules, keeping things cleaned up, food out of the way, having protocols for where dumpsters are put, just some very, very basic placement and sanitation is a great place to start.
Now, if someone in a facility happens to see that little mouse running along the wall, or something flying around maybe by a high light, what's the major next step that should be taken besides calling their pest provider? Is there anything that they can do until the company comes in to help them address the problem, what they should do immediately?
Absolutely. First, whenever there's some kind of a pest sighting, you know, of course, there's a matter of degree, I suppose. You know, you could notice something that you perceive to be relatively minor and make a notation of those things on the pest sighting logs that should be made available for all employees, whether that's placed in the break room or sanitation office or someplace that's available. But and then as part of routine service, those things should be reviewed and investigated by the technician. More maybe to the point of your question, you have that instance like you cite of a mouse. And, you know, they're sighted from time to time, and they're popping from one hiding place to another. And for sure that needs to be noted. But I would also advise that there are things that people could do immediately to try to contain that problem. And there are some really nifty products out there. It's basically one brand name is Border Control, but there might be others. But it's essentially a very, very long strip of fly paper, glue paper. And it's like it comes in like 60-foot rolls, and you could deploy this stuff on the floor or on the back of a trailer if you happen to know that there was a rodent inside, or if you saw a mouse pop into a pallet to hide. You know, you could pretty quickly put down, you know, strips of this glue paper all the way around that pallet and, you know, capture the mouse or have a good chance of capturing the mouse when it came out. So much better to do that than to allow a rodent to run wild in the plant, getting into who knows what kind of mischief for a number of days before the technician arrives.
Any thoughts, Sharon, what you would recommend?
I think he's really, you know, nailed it. He's done a great job outlining that, you know, the pest sighting log is key, and then anything that they can do in the interim that's approved, or find somebody in the plant who is approved to take those short-term measures, that would be it.
So what are some examples of action thresholds for pests? And if you could explain to our listeners what an action threshold is.
Yeah, that's a very timely topic these days. Everybody is asking for action thresholds, and it's a tricky kind of a topic. Maybe I'm overeducated or nerdy about this particular topic, but it kind of goes back to the origins of some of the theory of integrated pest management, where as it was developed in agriculture, you know, there were determinations made for a particular crop that if you had a particular population, that the cost of the control would be justified with according to the damage that would occur from yield loss. And then you could have an action threshold somewhat lower than that to give yourself a little bit of time to, you know, put out the control method. Now, in food processing, none of that applies very well. We don't have yield losses that are cut and dried. Actually, they're very rare in agriculture as well, but we don't have those kind of yield losses that we can associate with a particular population level. What we're really doing is trying to find a population level and assessing the risk, okay? And it becomes a very arbitrary number that invariably is picked. And it's further complicated when you think about the different zones within a food processing facility and the wide array of different pests and the fact that you could have a very complex matrix of different action thresholds if you were to take this concept, you know, out and fully develop it. The reality is, in practice, that an arbitrary number is picked. Let's say it's 10 of a particular species in a pheromone trap, or a mouse caught, you know, several service visits in succession, or numbers of mice captured, and things of that nature. So it's greatly simplified as it's used in practice these days. And then another question has to be, what's this threshold? What's the action to be taken? An action to do what? It might be, in some cases, basically the automatic expectation that you're going to do more inspections or deploy more monitoring devices, or it might be, in some situations, kind of the automatic authorization for a technician to apply certain kinds of pesticide applications appropriate for the area and all that. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is good communication. And you shouldn't even need to have an action threshold for that. There ought to be good, thorough communication with the technicians, contact at the plant. And maybe if there's a high number reached, so the so-called action threshold, maybe it gets escalated up to higher management or something of that nature. But good communication is really the key. And then somebody in that position of authority can assess that along with all the other demands that are on their mind, you know, with production schedules and the next holiday weekend coming up with available downtime and maintenance needs and just all those things in addition to this pest issue and then figure out what's to be done. Sharon?
That's like my mind goes blank because Jerry really covers things so thoroughly. You know, the action thresholds of what to do is, like he said, very arbitrary. And each company usually sets their own based on sometimes the sensitivity of the product, the sensitivity of the population consuming the product. You know, how common is this problem? You know, do they only see it once or twice a year? Is it something that's ongoing, like, say, a flower beetle that seems to be a lot more common and maybe they see one a week? You know, do you do additional things because of that? You know, those really are judgmental calls and internal. Maybe they set up additional cleaning or look at something more closely, but by and large, it's usually a case by case. As Jerry mentioned, what zone is it in? What is the product? What is the population consuming that product amongst all those other schedules and things, and figuring out what the best fit is for that problem?
Sure. Do you find that more of the companies you're dealing with these days want to steer clear of pesticides and want to use more natural ways to deter pests? And what kind of challenge does that pose for you?
Well, yes, absolutely. And really, at the outset here, I would say that in food processing, the use of pesticides is remarkably minimal in the big scheme of things. We really do, by and large, a wonderful job with sanitation and exclusion and inspection, all those non-chemical measures. And then when it does come to pesticide selections, you know, there's a real honest, good effort to select the options that have the lowest impact. Now, at the same time, we have to have those tools. We have to have the big guns out there available, and we sure use them. Okay, so you know, from time to time, it might call for fumigation, or it might call for fogging applications, or things of that nature. But on balance, looking at the big picture, our pesticide use is pretty low impact. And then there's also considerations like organic production, and we do a lot of work in that area. And there's a step-by-step process for what's acceptable to be used in organic production facilities. We help people with those plans. Quite a lot of conventional pesticides are actually used in organic production facilities, but the plans are approved by their organic certifying agent, and precautions are taken to protect the organic integrity of products. So
that's interesting.
But so there's lots of attention to that paid, but by and large, our pesticide use is fairly minimal and very thought out very responsibly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I might add that, you know, a lot of times it's targeted to those areas outside of the food and the food production area. So let's target those areas where we aren't doing those activities first to try and keep the pest from even getting into that.
Right. So as we wrap up today, what one thing about pest management would you like all food safety professionals to keep in mind? Sharon, let's start with you.
Wow. I would say that it's an ongoing process for pest management. And the most important thing to know is that you know, we need good specimens to help with good identifications. And so the, you know, as long as they can get us specimens that can be identified, we'll do our best to help help them get that under control if needed.
Not burned ones, right?
Not burned ones. That, yeah, once they go through the incinerator, it's a whole new ball game. But yeah, it's, you know, it's ongoing. Things are always changing and moving. So, you know, different areas, product constantly coming in and going out. It's an ongoing process that they just continually need to be on top of.
I'm going to fall back to something I think I mentioned early on, and that's the taking that 10,000 foot view and thinking about coordination and integration and communications. Boy, the most successful programs that I can think of out there seem to be those where the maintenance department is really bought into the program and, you know, is well coordinated with what needs to be done by the sanitation department, for example, and so many other aspects of that communication and coordination within the plant really is key. You can't hire a pest management service and you know, wipe your hands of it and think that they're taking care of it. It's too much of a partnership, and that communication and coordination throughout the whole, amongst all the partners and all the participants, that's where I would go.
And like you said earlier, Jerry, it all comes back to culture, right?
Yes, yes.
I want to thank both of you for joining me on the podcast today. It's been a really interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Sharon and Jerry for this very informative discussion and for IFC for sponsoring this episode. For more information about the many ways IFC can help you design and implement a pest management program, visit the show notes page in your podcast player or on our episode page on our website at foodsafetymagazine.com/podcast/pest-management-program. We hope you enjoyed this special episode of Food Safety Matters. We'll talk to you soon.